This is Ron Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. Meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio.
If I dumb all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Hey KBOO listeners, join us at the station on February 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. for our Stupid KBOOFID First Friday Arts Walk. Enjoy art, listen to music, savor drinks, get your face painted, and pick up a Valentine's gift from one of our amazing vendors. There's something for everyone. We can't wait to see you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11.02 a.m. Next up is The Bike Show.
Hello and welcome to the KBOO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBOO.FM. All shows are archived on www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. We are happy and honored to be carried also by fellow community stations across the land, including a new station, KORC of Corvallis, Oregon, and in the UK, and are thankful for that support. Thank you, our listeners, for joining us today. I hope that this day, which in Portland involves some rain and snow, finds you and your loved ones as well and healthy as can be at these times of fire, war and suffering, relentless attack on environmental and social protections and programs, and attempts to dismantle the rule of law. And I'm trying not to be too depressing today, but hopefully it's also a time of solidarity, community, resistance, and rebuilding. My name is Alon Robb, and I'm joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler, and our engineer is Ty Walker. Nedra, good day. How are you today? Nedra, are you on the line? Oops. Nedra is in another part of the country. Can you hear me, Nedra? We lost Nedra, so we'll try to reach her in a minute here. In the first half of the show, our guest will be Professor of Law Daniel Rolfe, co-founder of the Earth Rise Law Center at Portland's Lewis and Clark College. Professor Rolfe has been in the forefront of legal battles to protect endangered species and has been an avid cyclist for over 45 years. In the second half of the show, Nedra will speak with Marcus Robinson, co-founder and executive director of Ride for Racial Justice, a nonprofit that does essential work to ensure access to resources, education, and community for Black, Indigenous, and people of color cyclists, so that in the organization's words, everyone can feel safe, free, and empowered to ride a bicycle. Nedra, are you on the line? Can you hear me, Nedra? We'll have to Hi, Nedra. Good to hear you.
Okay.
Well, I'm always glad to hear your voice. It's a voice I love and treasure. So, how are you doing today?
Doing okay today. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I do. And I know that last week you conducted a workshop. What was that about?
Oh, yeah. The workshop was about for community leaders around listening and healing. So they're doing community work, deep community work, and what are some ways to bring in opportunities to bring healing through to their communities through listening, like listening circles, oral histories, like using those things to activate. To bring in that as a layer was looking at trauma-informed, as a social worker, like their trauma-informed principles that are kind of key, so that when you're doing community work, you're not reinflicting harm that have been done to communities historically disinvested in, such as redlining and disinvestment, etc. So yeah, we had a four-hour workshop. An artist joined me who led a project as a way to use art to bring people together, have a shared vision, to work collectively. And then I did it was interactive, had the other part of the session, and it was an interactive conversation about history, about place, and also about things like values, trauma-informed care, and just bringing care, mindfulness into the practice of community work and building community, and addressing just various issues that folks are trying to solve, from like food scarcity to employment, climate justice. So it was a multifaceted.
All the small issues, yeah, of life. Sounds like wonderful work. I will say goodbye for now, and we'll rejoin at the half-hour mark. Usually I have a few news items, but today I will skip them. And I just want to mention that for those living in Portland, every Wednesday there's a wonderful social gathering of cyclists at Migration Brewing on 3947 North Williams Boulevard. And it's between 3 and 6. Today's gathering will also be a birthday party for Jonathan Ma, publisher of the excellent BikePortland.org, and a man who has done much to build community and a sense of fun and camaraderie in the City of Roses. So happy birthday, Jonathan, and thank you for your important and good work. Our first guest today is Daniel Rolfe, professor of law and co-founder of the Earthrise Law Center at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. The center is an environmental legal clinic and is, in its own words, a team of impassioned attorneys and staff working to achieve targeted environmental improvements while teaching the next generation of advocates to do the same. Professor Rolfe has been in the forefront of legal battles to protect endangered species and has also been an avid cyclist for over 45 years. Good day, Professor Rolfe, and welcome to the Bike Show.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
Tell us, please, about your early cycling experiences. Were you always a cyclist? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in a suburb of Denver, Colorado. And I think I got my first bike when I must have been 7 or 8 years old. I got the kind of classic banana seat Stingray. Mine was a beautiful gold color. And we had a field behind our house with humps of dirt, and we would go ride around on the trails, and I'd ride on the streets and sidewalks of our suburban neighborhood. So, you know, I was on my bike all the time as a kid.
Those early cycling memories are so powerful. I still remember my first bicycle was bought in a Jaffa store that was very crowded with a million and one things, and my parents bought me this bicycle. A company was Flying Camel, and the logo was a flying camel, so I still remember that wonderful bicycle. And you've been a rider for many years. I think I read someplace 45 years at least.
Well, I've been a bike commuter for 45 years. I've probably, I've ridden a bike for 55 or almost 60 years.
But who's counting the years?
Exactly.
So where do you usually cycle? Do you have a regular route to work, home, where?
Yeah, sure. So I teach at Lewis and Clark Law School, And I live only about 3 miles away in Southwest Portland. And so I've been riding my bike to work for 37 years or something like that to the law school. I commuted to other jobs prior to that. So I've been a bike commuter for maybe 45 years. It takes me 10 or 15 minutes or so to get from my house to the law school if I go directly. A lot of times, just for fun and exercise, I have a variety of routes where I stretch it into a 10 or 12 mile ride or something like that, just to enjoy some additional time on the bike.
Is my working?
Are there any favorite rides you've took during that time in Portland, or I know you've taught and worked in other lands?
Yeah, you know, I've spent almost 40 years riding in Portland. I love to ride in the West Hills in particular. I've always liked hills, and so I can ride up in the West Hills up to Council Crossing or something like that. I've done that hundreds and hundreds of times. Because there's very little traffic and lots of good hills to climb. One of my favorite routes to work now is I'll come downtown and then get on the Springwater Corridor and ride down the river. I'll ride down the river and up through the cemetery to Lewis and Clark. So lots of good rides here in Portland, but I've also been fortunate to ride in places around the world. When I was on sabbatical about 20 years ago or so, my family lived in Mexico for a year, and I joined a Mexican road racing team. And I still keep in touch to this day with a couple of my teammates in Mexico, and you know, they're sort of like brothers to me. So that was a great experience. You know, for my 60th birthday, my brother joined me, and my brother and our wives rode the Galibier, the pass, huge pass in the French Alps that the Tour de France oftentimes races over. So that was a really fun way to mark my birthday. So I've been fortunate to, you know, be on my bike a lot and you know, ride in places around the world. I taught in South Korea, and South Korea has incredible off-street bike paths that go for hundreds of miles through the country. So one of the things I'd love to do is to go back to South Korea and take a long-distance ride there. So, yeah, I've been really lucky. I was captured by rebels riding bikes in Uganda one time.
Right after
law school, I worked very briefly in Uganda, and I had an old one of the first mountain bikes, and I took my mountain bike over there, and I was on a ride outside of the capital and sort of got interdicted by a group of Ugandan sort of rebels on cheap Indian bicycles. And so there was a fleet of slender Ugandan men and this big goofy looking red-haired guy on American mountain bike. So I've had lots of bike adventures around the world.
Well, I'm happy the rebels released you. And was it the Army of God, or who were they? Were they fighting Idi Amin?
Well, actually, it was a series of community groups that actually sort of overthrew the last really evil Ugandan dictator. Unfortunately, they also put into power the current dictator of Uganda, who's been the president of Uganda since I was there in 1987.
He's obviously doing a great job, and they just want him in power.
Right.
Well, moving from Uganda and dictators and rebels to the streets of Portland, so over the years, how has cycling changed? If you compare, let's say, riding 30 years ago in Portland to today, what are some of the changes you noticed?
Sure. You know, I started riding and commuting in Portland in the late 80s. And back then, it was a little bit of a free-for-all. You know, there were very few bike lanes. And I rode my bike in a lot of places, but I would just have to, you know, just scrunch over to the side of the road and kind of fight it out with traffic. And then into the 90s and early 2000s, the city of Portland, I think, really made it its first real concerted effort to make cycling more of a transportation option and to really improve the city's cycling infrastructure. So for me, that was sort of a classic time, you know, in Portland bike circles, a lot of infrastructure, a lot of bike lanes. Today, most of my ride from Southwest Portland through here and Southeast, back across the East Side and back to Lewis and Clark will be almost all on bike lanes, which is great. So that's sort of a classic time, the rise of Portland bike culture, so many events, a lot of races. I was a cyclocross racer. And, you know, Portland had the highest rates of people riding cyclocross races in the whole country. And, you know, those races were just like a huge celebration. There'd be like 1,200 racers at the largest races. It was amazing. And then I think it started to get more challenging.
I want to get to the challenges in a minute.
Sure.
But first, you are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBO.FM. All shows are also available on www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com and are carried by fellow community radio stations in the U.S. and England. My name is Alon Raab, and our guest in the first half of the hour is law professor Daniel Rolfe, co-founder of the Earthrise Law Center and an ardent cyclist. You mentioned the changes, the challenges, and I want to get to them soon. But before that, a little bit about your career and good work in the world. So you studied geology in college, and then what made you decide to turn to law? How did you find environmental law, not maritime law or tort law, which makes me always think of a cake or something for some reason? How did you decide on environmental law?
Yeah, well, I think I grew up in Colorado, and our family always spent a lot of time outdoors and hiking in the mountains and that sort of thing. And so I was always interested in the environment. I think I was a geology major. I did like science a lot, and I was a rock collector when I was a kid, but I was a geology major because I was really interested in the environment and even protecting the environment. And in those days, environmental studies was not a major that anyone offered. And so for me, it was kind of an easy transition from geology to environmental law because I always was interested in the law as a tool for change. And so I always knew I wanted to combine my interest in the environment with law. So I went to law school, and I was fortunate to meet a lot of terrific people that were interested in a similar thing, study from some of the early very well-known and accomplished professors in environmental law. And then not too long after my graduation, I was fortunate to go to Lewis and Clark, which for 50 years has been a leader among American law schools in environmental law.
And you, besides teaching classes on environmental law, you co-founded the Earthrise Law Center, and are now, again, its director. Tell us a little bit about that center. What are some of the cases it handles or the work it does?
Sure. So our environmental law clinic has two primary goals, and one is to serve clients that are interested in protecting the environment. And the other is to provide law students with hands-on experience in environmental law so we can train the next generation of environmental lawyers. We're a public interest law firm, so we work oftentimes pro bono for organizations and people interested in protecting the environment. Our cases run a gamut. Oftentimes we're in federal court, but we do everything from work to try to protect water quality to try to keep water cold for species like salmon here in the Northwest. We work on land-related issues, so protecting forests. I have worked for over 30 years on efforts to conserve and restore salmon and steelhead runs in the Columbia River Basin. So those, you know, we have kind of a wide variety of practice in environmental and natural resources law.
And what have been some of the successes, and where have you fallen short? What are there some cases that you wish you had a different judge or lived in a different legal system? Or
I mean, our attorneys filed a lawsuit that eventually resulted in a settlement that closed the last remaining large coal-fired power plant.
Hooray! Bravo!
In the state of Oregon. So that was certainly a very notable victory of our clinic. We've had many lawsuits involving the Clean Water Act, for example, that have cleaned up pollution. I think our case challenging the federal agency's management of federal large federal dams in the Columbia River Basin has had a lot of positive impact on salmon and steelhead populations and led to changes in the way those dams are managed that benefit salmon. Our clients are continuing their efforts to try to convince federal agencies and Congress to remove the four lower dams, lower federal dams on the Snake River, which are crucial in order to restore salmon populations as well as protect and hopefully recover orcas in the southern Puget Sound. So, yeah, those are some of the key issues.
Sounds like wonderful work. But, so, for instance, you know, the city of Portland, in the city of Portland now, Zenith Oil wants to establish, you know, a port to move their oil, their trains carrying oil. And there's been a lot of opposition to it. The city manager or administrator just said we have to proceed. So would that be a case, for instance, that you might also get involved in, or to stop Zenith or to stop PG from building, you know, a substation in Forest Park, or those?
We've been involved in some local issues like that. I think those are terrific efforts. Our clinic hasn't been directly involved in those particular efforts, but oftentimes if you look at almost any sort of public interest in environmental law suits or legal efforts going on in the Portland metro area or Oregon, you'll typically see a Lewis and Clark Law School alum involved in one of those efforts.
Our time is just zooming by as fast as the people in power now are dismantling every social environmental program. And I don't mean to depress you, but getting back to cycling, I saw in Bike Portland, there was a lively debate about how Portland can, you know, how Roger Geller, the city's bicycle administrator, wrote a thoughtful piece about how to increase cycling, make it safer. And you had, I liked your response because it had very specific actions, very practical, how we could improve things. So tell us, please, about some of those ideas you had.
Sure. I was responding to a piece where some folks, especially in the city of Portland, were saying, you know, we need more marketing. You know, let's have more marketing and maybe we can get more people on bikes. And it's great to have sort of positive messages out there to encourage people. But in my view, if we really want to make cycling a meaningful part of our transportation system, we need to make a lot of changes. We need to take better care of the infrastructure that we have. You know, I just rode my bike down here, and sweeping is often terrible.
Yeah.
The plastic bollards that are supposed to protect bike lanes are routinely trashed and run over. I was riding my bike down Barber Boulevard, and yes, there's a bike lane, but buses are going by you know, a couple of feet away. No one uses that bike lane except for, you know, very avid, very experienced cyclists like me. And while I appreciate it, that's not going to get the average person out on a bike. We need more off-street bike paths. We need
dedicated staffed bike parking facilities downtown. Mm-hmm. We need better enforcement of traffic laws. You know, that's one of the things I've seen in my 40 or my 37 years mm-hmm. of commuting here. Within the last 5 years, it's crazy on the streets. People disobeying traffic laws, it just feels a lot more dangerous. And even I'm more mm-hmm. frightened when I'm riding around. So I know enforcement is challenging and sometimes enforcement efforts are unevenly applied. Mm-hmm. But we need more enforcement because the reason we have traffic laws is to keep all of us safe. And mm-hmm. if you look at the statistics on deaths, unfortunately, among cyclists, mm-hmm. pedestrians, even drivers, those have skyrocketed. And, you know, this idea of vision zero, no one dying, right. we haven't come close to that. And mm-hmm. so we have to enforce our laws. We need more off-street bicycle paths. Mm-hmm. In Europe and places like South Korea, there are off-street paths that go everywhere. Mm-hmm. And people feel, the average person feels much safer on a path like that. Even I do. When mm-hmm. I ride from here to work, I'll go on the Springwater path, and that's an absolute pleasure. Otherwise, I'm sort of battling it out with these death machines on the road. But when you're on a dedicated bike path, you feel much safer, you mm-hmm. are much safer, and the average person is going to use that infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with all these suggestions and what you said about cycling. Now, I ride every day, but and I'm a careful cyclist, but the number of people, you know, checking their email while they're driving or opening a door. You also mentioned, you know, tax gas and cars a lot more, maybe close some streets downtown, create pedestrian areas, electing leaders who view cycling as important. And one of the news items I wanted to bring up earlier was about the European Union, where different committees and transport leaders met and said, cycling is really important, and we're going to do concrete things to make it safe. So not just, you know, paying lip service. You also mentioned providing tax advantages for buying and using bikes and electric bikes, cracking down on bike thefts. All of those things, I think, are wonderful, wonderful suggestions.
Sure, and the law can play a real role in that. Things like tax structure that advantages bike transportation, laws that actually really go after cars when there is an accident that results in the death or injury of a mm-hmm. cyclist. You know, we need much stronger laws that prosecute that sort of behavior.
Mm-hmm. You said also, you've written that, you know, marketing is wishing something will happen. We need to do the hard work to try to make it actually happen. We get the society we collectively decide to make. In the last minute or two of our half an hour, where do you, you know, personally find sources of strength and hope to continue the good work you're doing and to continue cycling? What are your sources of strength and hope?
Sure. Well, just being out on the road on a bike is always wonderful. Mm-hmm, yeah. It gives you time to think and, mm-hmm. you know, exercise, enjoy the outdoors, and seeing fellow cyclists mm-hmm. is a source of hope. As a teacher, we have tremendous young people at Lewis and Clark, at the college, at the law school. These young folks want to make a difference. They're smart. They're dedicated. They want to go out and make our country and the world a better mm-hmm. place. And for me, that's always a huge source of inspiration and hope.
Hmm. Well, we could probably go on for a few more hours here, but time for the next guest almost. So you are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, live, 90.7 FM if you have a radio, or streaming on kbo.fm. And all shows going back to 2001 are archived on www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. We are happy and honored to be carried by fellow community radio stations across the U.S. and in England. We have been speaking with Daniel Rolfe, professor of law and co-founder of the Earthrise Law Center at Portland's Lewis and Clark College. Thank you, Professor Rolfe, and all the best with your teaching activism, and cycling. We will take a short musical break. When we come back, Nedra will speak with Marcus Robinson, co-founder and executive director of Ride for Racial Justice. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, it sounds. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run. Finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployed lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. And finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no.
The board president, co-founder, and executive director of Ride for Racial Justice, based in Denver, Colorado. Marcus can mostly be found on a bicycle. He is a quip master. He is at the Velodrome. He's also an organizer. And he is also an awarded chef and is known as a barbecue pit master and a knight of Sufferlandria. Marcus describes himself as one who pushes boundaries for racial justice and equity, and has lived many experiences to prove that. Welcome on, Marcus. How are you today?
Nedra, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I got you. Great. Thank you. And thank you for that great introduction. I didn't know that was me, actually. I thought you were speaking of someone else.
No, definitely talking about you, and I'm excited to learn more. So tell us about yourself. Your bio is very extensive. I feel like you've accomplished a lot in life, as well as just as a, you know, as an artist. I will say riding the bike is artful, as well as cooking. Can you tell us about this being a competitor on Top Chef? And also, what is the Knight for Sufferlandria? I have not heard of this.
Well, actually, thanks, Ned. I'm going to start with the hardest question first, or explanation of a Knight of Sufferlandria. So there is a small cadre of folks across the world, probably several thousand, And every once in a while, we are able to embark upon this crazy cycling adventure. But it's on a trainer. It is 10 hours, well, 10 to 12 hours of 10 videos that are the most intense videos you've ever done on a trainer. And it's like doing one interval for basically 10 hours. Some of the intervals lasted up to 90 minutes. And the secret to this, Nedra, is that between each video, which has names like Hell Hath No Fury, Nine Hammers, and things of that nature, but get a 10-minute break, right? 10-minute break. And if you're not on your bike in those 10 minutes, that effort is done and you don't get a chance to complete the task. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And so this is consecutive. This is consecutive, like, videos?
Yes. Consecutive videos from Wahoo Supperfest. And it is a pain fest, to say the least. And you have to have all of your food, you have to have your drink and all that in front of you, because you don't have time to go get anything. You have to drink on the bike, and I think I consumed just over 12,000 calories in that effort. But it was fun, so to speak. So I am proud to say I'm a knight, and I have knight on my Strava profile, and I've got this coat of arms that I wear for all of us knights in Sufferlandria, and it's great. And when people see it, they go, oh, you're one of those, and then they know. So it's pretty fun.
Wow, congratulations. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So, how long have you been a knight?
Oh, shoot, it's been probably 7 years now. 7 years, and I've got the gray hairs on my beard to prove it. So it was a great experience, and it's a group of folks that when you see the KOS on their bike, it's, you know, that you've done something special. So I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, that sounds really incredible. And you have a coat of arms, so that's kind of cool too.
Yeah, I'll have to send that to you.
Yes, please do. So what is Top Chef, Barbecue Night, Pit Master? How did you become such a fabulous barbecuer?
I don't think we have enough time for that, but my dad, Irvin, who's since deceased, his name is Irvin, and most everyone called him Irv. And Dad loved barbecue, and I just kind of sat down and kind of watched him do his thing. And from that point, I started experimenting on a few things of my own, of course, under his watchful eye, of course. And then he started making barbecue sauce, and then I took his barbecue sauce and took it to the next level and named it Irv's Barbecue Sauce in honor of my dad. And, it's become like a staple here with all of our friends in the barbecue world, but I've kind of taken to barbecue as the other part of my cycling journey. I enjoy cycling so much that when I come home, doing barbecue is just as fulfilling, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's that peaceful place that I can kind of go and no one can take me out of that.
That's a good thing. Yeah. It sounds like you can compete because of passion, because of, like, I don't know, you see the importance of these. It's not an activity. These are like ways of living and being in the world. And you like live it the most when you're there is what I'm hearing. Even if it's suffering, you're going to live it the most. So that's really cool. How did you get into riding a bike?
Wow. My mom I guess I'll be sharing my age, kind of, sort of. But mom and dad bought my first bicycle when I was probably 10 years old, and it cost them $5. And it was a used bike from my neighbors that lived behind our house across the alley. And that family had an old beater bike. It was a coaster bike. And they sold it to my parents to give to me for $5. And that bike became my escape platform, just because anytime I was on a bike, I was free. And part of the thing with Ride for Racial Justice is our motto is bikes equals freedom. And at that young age, I knew what the bike was to me. It was freedom. It was freedom to explore, freedom to see new things, experience things, and just find out who I am as a person. And that, I think, from that young age to where I am now in that AARP generation, I am blessed to still be able to ride a bike. I'm not racing crits or road races anymore. I'm staying on the gravel, which kind of goes back to why I was riding the bike when I was a kid, to explore new things. Riding gravel gives you that same freedom out here in Colorado, where you can see bald eagles, you can see bison, you can see elk, you can see moose, all in, you know, in a 2-hour span on the bike and the gravel. There's no cars, there's no political agenda when you're riding your bicycle. It's just a beautiful place where I'm at peace.
Yeah, peace. That sounds also peaceful. Can you ride from your home out to these areas that are more natural spaces to get to gravel roads, or are you, what does that look like for you?
Well, that's a great question. For me, where we live, I can get into the dirt in about 20 minutes from the behind the house, which is great. And I actually ride around the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, which is an interesting place because that's where they used to do a lot of testing with during the nuclear program back in the late 60s and 70s. And the Rocky Mountain Arsenal has been decommissioned and they've turned it into a nature preserve. And so you've still have bison and all kinds of deer, pronghorn deer, snakes, all kinds of four-legged creatures, and it's just a peaceful place to ride. So for me, that's 20 minutes. But if I want to ride with the fellas, I got to drive about 45 minutes to an hour to get up around the Boulder Lions area and ride on those farm roads, which is just really, it's just a great place, great place.
That sounds really nice. Yeah, peaceful and I don't know, photogenic in a sense, but you're not taking photos. You're on your bike. Well, or maybe you're taking photos too.
That is kind of interesting. And I think as you talk to most cyclists who spent their lives on bikes, a lot of the times you're spending your time looking at the wheel in front of you or looking at your handlebars or not really looking up. Since I stopped doing all that competitive stuff per se, I will stop and take pictures and we hang out and it's more of a camaraderie. It's a enjoying the moment. And so, and I say that over the weekend, I competed in the Old Man Winter Bike Rally up in Lyons and it was a 40-mile jaunt in the dirt, ice, snow, and mud. My bike is covered in dirt and mud. I was covered in mud and dirt. It was the most fun I'd had all year. And that's the one time that I did not stop and take a picture because I didn't do it. I did not do it. We were just kind of hammering and having a good time, but didn't have time to stop because if I stopped, I would have fell over. And I was muddy enough as it was, so didn't want to do that.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. You're listening to KBOO Radio, and we're with our guest, Marcus Robinson of Ride for Racial Justice out of Denver, Colorado. Maybe a few more who are you questions, and then we'll get into talking about your organization that you lead. So Your nickname, Sir Big Ring, is that from your competitive days? Is that from your Sir Philandria days because of the Sir? Or is that from, you know, what, how did you get your name?
Well, okay, I added the Sir to the Big Ring. So the Big Ring comes from a name that was given to me by cycling royalty here in the U.S. His name is Davis Finney. He's a dear friend of mine. He's won the most races of any American here in the United States, and some 150 races, I believe. Racing the Coors Classic. He's a Olympian along with his wife, Connie Carpenter. But Davis was struck down with Parkinson's, and there was one year that I did one of his rides, and I'm out riding with Davis and all these other folks, and I'd always admired Davis as a cyclist and what he was doing as a human, as a professional. And even though I'd never met him, during my crit career, I had to have my bike like his, because he was just he was just a stud. And eventually I got to meet Davis and got to ride with him a lot, and he used to sit on my wheel. And he would get to the point where anytime I'd go on a ride with DP and everybody else, Davis would just sit right behind me. And it was like, for me, it was an honor. And he called me Big Ring. He said, Big Ring. And so that has stuck for the last 15 so odd years, I believe. And so I took the Big Ring, and people that know me and know Davis, they'll still call me that by that name. And of course I had to add the Sir to it. So it's Sir Big Ring, and I wear it well. But it also goes to the fact that I did not like to get into the small chain ring up front. So I'm a big guy, and big guys like to sprint. Davis was a sprinter, and so Big Ring it was.
Wow. So much cycling history right here. Thanks for sharing. Just to kind of turn into like your advocacy work, your organization, and just what racial justice has meant for a lot of people. I actually interviewed someone here who talked about the organization. You yourself have had your own experiences with experiencing racism and desegregation. Can you tell us, you know, how that was a factor, or just tell us about that, or how it was a factor in where you are today with Ride for Racial Justice?
Well, you know,
big question.
that's a big question, and you know, there's not a short answer to my transition to where I am with this organization. But suffice it to say that standing in social justice and doing the right thing has been in my family since I was a child, with my grandparents, my grandma, and myself and my cousin Judy integrated the first pool in Dodge City, Kansas, which had been segregated. So doing things the right way, standing on business, as the youngsters would say now, has been part of who I am. Civil rights, all those things I watched my grandparents suffer through, even though we didn't understand it, we knew what they were going through. And then as a child that had watched, you know, the assassination of JFK, watching the assassination of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Robert Kennedy, and going through watching the riots and so forth, and trying to understand what civil rights and prejudice and racism was, it wasn't until I became an adult that I fully understood what my parents had gone through, and my grandparents before them. And so when the opportunity came for me to start with my co-founder, Neil Henderson, RFRJ, it came out of the pain of George Floyd. When George was murdered, I posted something on social media about that, because for all the years and all the crazy things that I've done in my life, this was the one part that was really changing, the one incident that really changed my life, right? It was the fact that I was now scared to be a black person, to be riding my bicycle, because the world and the country, well, just the country actually, was going through this transformation, and it was just not a happy place to be. It was a scary place to be. And as a cyclist, you know, sometimes you're riding with the group and sometimes you're riding alone. And sometimes when I ride, Madrid is not conducive to being a brown person out in the middle of the country all alone on a two-lane road.
I can imagine. The sense of, it's not just discomfort. It's uncertainty about, the next bend, what could happen. So who's going to be there to help you if something happens?
You're exactly right. And then, you know, when I posted on social, and Neil is also my coach during all that Sufferlandria stuff as well, but Neil said we needed to do something about it, and that's when we had our first community ride 5 years ago, where it grew from like 100 people at the first ride to over 600 at the next. And we found, Nedra, and this is like the really crucial point in the transition for me from being just a cyclist and a sports person to go from just sitting on the sidelines to becoming an activist, is that we found that cycling, you cannot be mad when you're on the bicycle. You have no political agendas when you're on the bicycle. You know, you're out there smiling, you're having fun, you're speaking, you're just enjoying life. And it's the only place we can actually be free, which brings me back to where when I was a child. And so when we started talking about what's going on in the world with the George Floyd murder and everything else, and the Black Lives Matter movement, and just the awakening of all this, these guys in hoods that all of a sudden come into the forefront, we found that we have a lot more in common than we don't, right? We're more in common. But
a lot more,
We're speaking, Nedra, from the seat of a bicycle, where there are no boundaries. It's just you're enjoying it for the sake of enjoying the bike, and the conversations you have are real because you have no expectations. And so you get real world conversations where people are admitting things that they didn't know. I found out things about folks that don't look like me as well. So you have this sharing of information from the seat of a bicycle, where you would not have gotten that from just a conversation at a rally or a march. Those things are just fleeting. You know, when you're riding together with someone, you're in the moment. And the bicycle breaks down all those barriers. And yeah, it's kind of where we are.
Yeah, that's a, thank you for that, like, testimony. It's a very, like a critical look at the importance of bicycling and what it represents. Yeah, it's a form of freedom and transportation and exercise, but it's also like goodwill, it's community building, it is informative. Like, that's really incredible to break down some barriers and walls. I mean, we kind of need that right now. You know, in these last, since the election and this, since the inauguration, have you seen any, I don't know what the weather has been like up in Colorado, but has there been more people wanting to, inquiring about rights for racial justice, or wanting to join RISE, or new people showing up? Is there any new activity?
Yeah, we've actually shifted our programming. We were essentially a gravel-based community organization providing those access to folks to bicycle rides, where we provide, you know, bicycle transportation, housing, and so forth to go to the Steamboat Gravel Race. But going
this your ambassador program?
Yeah, with our ambassador program. And going into 25, after discussions with a lot of our alumni, and we've had over 100, we trained over 100 alumni in our program that are branched all over the U.S. And one of the things that we were hearing is that we need to do something different. And so our small board led by Neil Henderson, myself, Alicia and Ruben and Massimo, we just felt that, and Allison, we just felt that we needed to make a shift and invest more in our communities with our athletes. And so I say that to say that over the last 2 weeks, there's been an uptick in people reaching out to our organization and to us as individuals, asking us what we are doing as a leader in the community. And what we're saying is that, one, you will not cancel us. You can think you're going to cancel us, and I'm speaking directly to that person that is unjustly occupying 1600 Pennsylvania, that you can speak and you can tell us what you want to do with an executive action. You can do, you can write all those papers, all those signs, all you want to. At the end of the day, you will not cancel brown, black, the indigenous folks, the LGBTQ, the trans. You will not cancel any of us, period. We have lived,
period.
We've lived, right? So you can write something and say, okay, no more Black History Month, no Asian American Month, no more Pacific Island Month. Okay, fine, guess what? At the end of the day, we are still who we are. I'm still black. Asians are still Asian Americans. Natives are still Natives. You cannot cancel us. And so that being said, we are pushing as an organization to provide more access with our funding back into communities with our alums in certain places so they can build up their community, because obviously they're trying to cut all the money for nonprofits. And so, you know, we're blessed that we're getting funding, but now we have to give it back to help those who are not in the position to help themselves.
That's really powerful, like really sticking to that moral code and the belief in justice and peace and inequality, equity. How can people support and or, you know, like, join in with Rapid Racial Justice and the work that y'all are doing?
Oh, that's the easiest thing in the world. You can ping us on our... on our Instagram page, Rise for Racial Justice. You can also get a hold of us on, we won't be on Facebook long. We're going to be transitioning off of that platform and move over to Blue Sky. But currently you can reach us on IG, you can DM me, you can email me directly. And that's Marcus@riseforracialjustice.org. And I will give you some hints, we can chat and figure it out. But I think at the end of the day, it's all of us collectively moving together as one unit, and not to say no, not to be afraid, and not to think that we're going to be silenced. We cannot be silent.
Yeah, we cannot be silent. Very powerful and encouraging, Marcus. Thank you so much. Thank you for, we got to close. This has been a really great opportunity to, I will say, meet you and talk to you and learn more about your story, and just the work that you do just by living here on the earth. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Nedrin, and thanks, Alon. You guys are doing great work out there, and please stay in touch. Just stay in touch.
Yeah, will do. Will do. You have been listening to KBOO Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon. My name is Nedra Deadweiler. I would like to thank our guests, Daniel Rolf and Marcus Robinson, co-host Alon Robb, our engineer, Ty Walker, and Chris Smith and Josh Hetrick for making all shows available at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. A big thank you to you, our listeners. And I hope that in the coming months that everything is good for you, there's peace in the world. and I hope the days ahead will see more actions towards making our home, the Earth, more bike-friendly, environmentally conscious, and centered on human and planetary needs, on peace, justice, and equality. Thank you for joining us today. May your rides be safe, enlightening, and joyful.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.